Succession number 28416, reel number 8.
Bill, you were saying that there were still some Germans on the loose and these, your excellent coloured drivers came across a blockage in the road.
They were quite wonderful. This was this, these logs across the road or something. We were in the last log, so we didn't see much. And they had us send a signal to turn everybody around, which they backed away and came back. And then somebody jumped overboard and cleared the blockage. And they got us to Leipzig like anything. But of course they'd been doing it ever since they set out from, what was it called? Where did they go ashore in
Normandy.
France?
Normandy.
Their bit was the bit on the end one, really, wasn't it? I forget what their landing stage is called now.
Never mind.
Doesn't matter. But it was a long way from France to there. And they'd come all the way, of course. And it was absolutely marvellous. And they got us to Leipzig, and the battle was still going on in Leipzig, still firing in, firing out, and we ended up at an airfield not too far away from there. And shall we have a stop at that point, just for a moment?
Yes.
Because, well, when we got to Leipzig and then onto this airfield, I think we stopped probably, there were three transports, so there's going to be three Dakotas we're going to need to get away, and but they were there, and the airfield, I think we had a little walkabout, we probably needed it, stretch our legs, and some guys picked up bits of whatever they fancied that's lying around. I didn't pick up anything because I think I'd rather kept in the airplane till it took off again. I nearly got that name out then of the chap. Yes, I've got it. Yeah. He lives in Africa now. Oh, he was the one who was most court-martialed by the Germans.
This is the chap who went down
into... rude to the Germans.
This is the chap who went down into the town with the Americans you're now talking about.
Yes,
right?
Yes. He was a great one. He was the only one who got... Never mind, I'll come later. We send Christmas cards. Oh, come on, can you give me a moment to find his name? Because it's rather...
I think, Bill, you're going to continue... we're going to give up trying to hunt for this man's name, I think.
Yeah.
But you have a story that's related.
This'll carry it on. It'll be the same chap. Now, the next stage of our journey out of this lovely airfield, which I can't name, near Leipzig, and we all scramble on board, nice takeoff, three of them in formation, I think we're probably at the back again, and the American pilot flying us nicely along, Dakotas. I don't remember any picture of a landscape at all. I think we probably have got above the cloud, and that's all we see. While we're up there, of course, some people are very keen on flying and wish they had never had to give it up. And one of them gets up into the front cockpit and actually persuades the American to take a rest or take a short walk back while he flies it. And this chap is a dear friend. I won't give his name, but he ended up as Jomo Kenyatta's pilot in Africa when he later on in his career, and he still lives in South Africa now. So there we are, heading for England. Well, the next stop is England, really. But this friend who took over control just for a brief spell, I remember him asking, well, how do you navigate this thing? You don't need to do any navigation. Hadn't got a chart out even. And the American guy said, oh, I just follow the guy in front. And there were two more in front, so as long as he didn't lose sight of them, he was okay. And we landed at Bovingdon, England. Now, we hadn't seen a thing on the way there. I can't even remember seeing the lovely English Channel. But it must have been because it was cloudy. And they were above it. Bovingdon. Well, this is a reception centre for POW, so somebody had done some good working out of where to go down. Perhaps it was that time that it was American as well, I don't know. Bovingdon is just north of London. Yes, before you get to Luton, quite near Luton. Very near Luton. It isn't an airfield now. And there was a reception tent there, full of Red Cross ladies who were feeding us. I think we spoke about this. That's when we were just in your motor car.
Well, if we did, please can you repeat it?
Well, it was that all they had for us was Swiss roll, long Swiss rolls, long tables with long Swiss rolls on, and they'd chop it up in great big chunky lengths and feed us with it. And that was the first food we had in England when we got back. And we were... I don't know what else we were done to or done for, except we... It must be the same day that we ended there. Somewhere along the line, some doctors, but that must be later. We got tickets for rail travel and hit it off for home, individually. We must have done.
Did you have mixed feelings about being back in England?
Don't remember what feelings were, but I know I think on the trip over we said, ooh, we'll get some good grub when we get home to London. And so we naturally thought of what we were, the last thing we had done in England, which was to have a lovely steak at Simpson's in the Strand. I think it's in the Strand or Piccadilly or somewhere there. On our way to the going out. And so we went there, but that wasn't. We did we have something? Perhaps we did before we set off. No, I don't think so. We had to go there to get a train. Because we came out of Waterloo. We must have gone to Simpson's. I think what we actually had was a pork pie. And pork pies were quite the thing in the war, weren't they? Perhaps with the egg stuck in the middle, about 4 days old, something like that. And then we got on trains and chugged all the way for me to Bournemouth. And I remember trying to shop in Bournemouth to get some fudge for my wife, because, I'm still buying fudge for her now, actually. So it stayed a long time.
And can you remind me when you were married?
Well, we had been married, actually, on a trip to England during the war. I don't think we did that.
I don't think you mentioned
no,
that.
No, well,
before you were shot down in April-ish, roughly, of
41, yes.
You had got married.
I detailed to you the two trips that I thought were significantly useful to us.
Yes.
I didn't give you the one that took us to England. For we were in England for 2 days, 3 days. Last 2 days we would leave, during which we got married.
So you got married.
That was in fact on the. I'm sure it was on the 5th of March, 1941.
That's a date.
Because everything happens to me on that date. I got my first commission on that day, in 1935, into the REs. So that's. I mean, it was hardly a...
So as you hadn't mentioned that before, you've answered my next question, which is that you had a home to go to because your family was... you'd lost your mother at an early age. Your father...
Yes. Was still out in St Helena.
Was still out in St Helena. Your brother is either in the Middle East or back home in Australia.
In Aussie, yes.
And I was just wondering where you had, what home you had that you could call your own.
Yes.
But of course you've got...
In my girlfriend's home.
You've got wherever it is that your wife is living.
Well, she was my girlfriend, and then that day she became my wife.
Yes.
But we didn't know that within a month we were going to be half dead.
No, I understand. So you got... You went to Bournemouth, where she was living.
So I went straight. We went straight to Bournemouth. Went in. After all, it was only about a year since I'd been there. Oh no. No, that's 5 years. Yes.
It's four years since you'd seen her.
Well, I went into the same shop we used to get it from, and I haven't had any of that for donkey's years. So I arrived home just with nothing.
Except some fudge.
Except
some fudge. You arrived home with nothing.
No, they hadn't got any.
They hadn't got any.
Empty-handed, you see. It was terrible. Completely empty-handed. No money, no fudge.
What did she say when she saw you?
I don't remember. I remember one thing she said. I don't think I'll say that, because that would be... sound like something wrong. She'd just come home from the dentist's. And a pretty painful one, too. That's the first thing I can remember. But we weren't expected or anything. You see, there was nobody had passed any words.
And yeah. Tell me what happened thereafter. You, because I think you were demobbed very quickly, weren't you?
Yes, we demobbed. We did get sent off to a sort of getting out gathering, which was somewhere else, up in almost in Manchester somewhere, where people were being signed off or stayed in. And you had a medical there, so you were given a medical chip which said that you were fit or whatever, or you weren't. Some people weren't, of course. And off we went again. I think there was a period when you didn't really know whether you were going to be called back or not, because it seems to me that there might have been several months before I actually went to work. I can't remember how long. But the war was still on. Japan was still there. We must have been some sort of touch with them, because of the people who got back home to England, one of them, the mad one, got his name now too. He was in the Air Ministry at the time, and we asked him if he could ask the Air Ministry if we could borrow a Tiger Moth and go and tug our glider home. But they said no. Not surprising, because the war was still on. It wasn't really sensible asking, but it's all we knew about. So it stayed there, and we didn't get a Tiger Moth.
And did your glider... Your glider has stayed at Colditz all these years, hasn't it?
Yeah. And
has it come out just recently, or is it still there? Or has it disintegrated?
Well, there's still one in the museum, I think. I don't know whether it's full-size or not. Yeah, it's in the museum. Yeah.
But you don't know what happened to yours up in the roof?
No. The first person to go back to Colditz to have a look at it was Mike Alexander. This is a good story, yeah. And he went back with a girlfriend. He had a lot of girlfriends, but this sounded rather nice and looked rather nice. There's a picture in the Daily Express. Mike Alexander at Colditz against the chapel door with them. Perhaps they were getting married, I don't know. And he left his car in the village down below. Well, it's a town, really, but... All right for time?
Yeah.
And when he came back to it, must have been a bit of dust on it, because it was written on it, "Eine schöne Wagen," which to me means, what a lovely motor car. Because it was. It was a... it was a Bentley or a... The other one, like a Bentley. I say it was a Bentley. It was a really super Bentley. Open one, I guess, knowing him. Which he'd driven across Germany to get there. Probably paid for by the paper, of course. Yeah, but that made a lovely little article in the Express about the German boy who wrote that.
So when are you demobbed?
I don't know any German, so okay. I'd probably say it all wrong, but that's what was written on there.
When were you demobbed, Bill?
Oh, I think at that meeting we had to go to be medically cleared out, because you've got a thing called a clearance chit, which means you can go elsewhere, either to another camp or out. I don't know. I think it was quite soon.
And did you have trouble finding a job?
No, because my job was still going on here. Where are we? Salisbury? Yes. Was still going on here, waiting for me. So I probably should have started getting short of money, I should think. I don't know. We did bump into one chap who'd escaped from Colditz in Bournemouth. Now, you mention it. Yes, we were walking along Bournemouth footpath when Errol Flynn turned up from the other end. Errol Flynn had got out by pretending to be mad. And I think one of the stories they put over on the film was a mad person. And dear old Errol Flynn still behaved as if he was, because we hardly said a word to each other. But he had been pretending to be mad. I can only remember one illustration of it. There was a game of chess going on, and Black Campbell, who's still around and is a barrister who features in all the stories, and Errol Flynn came in and picked up his chessboard and smashed it over his head, and didn't say anything, just walked off, you know, humming a tune or something. And the Germans got him cleared out by the Red Cross before going home, was mad. And he wrote afterwards, in the film that they made of Colditz, they show Errol walking out of the castle gate, Dougie Barder's gate, and he stopped. He said he was crying with happiness at the thought of having got out. Now, he hadn't illustrated any thoughts of happiness or consideration or anything else up to that moment, but he got home. But only a few months before the rest of us. But that was Errol.
But when you met him on Bournemouth seafront, he still seemed a bit odd.
Well, yes. He just walked past and said hello, I think. Perhaps he wasn't sure who he was seeing. He'd never been mad to me. And I got my wife with me. And yeah. He's still alive. He's still alive. Errol Flynn. And I hope that might bring out the other name we're trying to get.
You're still hunting for it.
Yeah. Vaguely, at the back.
Well, Bill,
that's about as far as we can go. How long did you take to get back to work? Not long.
Because
as soon as I made contact with the chief, my boss was Stanley Little. Now, I'd heard from him in Colditz. He sent us a book once, which is all the fun for the Germans, really, in a way, because they wouldn't let me have it, because it was about tanks. We were a reinforced concrete gang, really. And the Germans read this. It said reservoirs and tanks on the page, and the Germans said, "Oh, tanks! Can't believe God, I have a book about tanks." So they kept it. So I never got the book. But he when I rang him, he would have said, "Well, come back when you feel like it, probably." But there's plenty of work on, and there really was, of course. And that's only 30 miles from Poole. So I used to go up and down, up and down.
So you have lived here in this part of the world really all your life, have you not?
Until getting the job with Salisbury, I was dotted about, but from Kent up to Ipswich to Woodbridge down to Salisbury.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we'll just conclude with this, if we may. You've maintained your interest in flying, and you have made one or two references on the tape to Old Sarum and Old Sarum Airfield. Would you just like to just say for a couple of minutes what it is that you're building there at here at this very august age. You're 89 next month. I know it's frightening, but you have given your birthday, so you've given it away. You are building with a friend. Can you tell me something about that? Just a moment or two?
I'll try to, yes. Thank you for that thought. It's not difficult to say why, because all the things that you've had on your machine there were really about flying until something went wrong. We were able to see that doing that sort of work was jolly good work, enjoyable. And so back in England, I ever had the thought that I never thought anything other than to carry on flying. Now this was sad because my wife doesn't approve of flying in the way it is flown now. Great big ships polluting the upstairs. And now this is silly and funny and good fun really, but see, over in France had been in 1910 a chap called names, isn't it awful? They suddenly vanish. The first person to fly in France round a circle was a relation of her mother's, whose family had been out there. Name won't come out. It'll come in a minute, perhaps. In 1910, France was just starting to fly. One of the best ones was this British chap whose family had been out there since the 1870 attack by the Germans on Paris. As a journalist, he was out there then, and his son was the one I'm talking about now, who was a keen bicyclist, as they are in France now, and he was also keen on aeroplanes once he'd heard about the Wright brothers.
How does this get us to what you're doing now in Old Sarum?
Well, it or nearly didn't do. However, this relation of my wife's, her aunts were all friendly with this one out in France, and aviation was going back and forwards all the time between them. And my wife showed me a photograph of her on Manchester Airfield, which was brand new then, with an airplane on it. And all these things said to me, airplanes is a subject that she recognises. But she doesn't actually. Doesn't think of anything of that link with the first Englishman to fly as a Frenchman in. And which is, I just like wildlife like she does. She loves the wildlife. I mean, the first thing we did this morning is feed all the birds.
Waiting.
There's a division of interest.
Yes, I'm still waiting for the connection with what you're doing in Old Sarum Airfield now.
Well, you see, the moment we dropped in the water that time, when I came up, ever since then I wanted to get back on the water. And if I ended up on the water and down there again, at 89, that wouldn't worry me too much, really, would it? Because it's reasonable age. Our crew are down there, down the bottom. But that isn't...
Your crew?
Those of our crew who didn't survive...
Are still at the bottom of the
Kalamata Bay.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they're good friends. However, that's the reason I'm doing water boat. But nobody in Britain...
But you haven't described what you're doing. Can you please...
Well, I'm building an amphibian. Because an amphibian can fly on the water as well as land. And there's no British design of a small size for a home builder to build something in his garage or workshop, as thousands of people are doing at the moment. They're all mostly American kit designs. There are four amphibians, but they're big two-seaters, expensive. 40,000 perhaps. What I'm building is costing no money because I'm doing it from scrap, and it's a British design which hasn't been used or made since the things were made in Supermarine's Spitfire factory, really. The Walrus was the last British walrus.
I think you showed me a picture of this, of one of these designs, of an aircraft flying in 1926. That was when it was first flying, was it?
Ah, now that's the one I'm using as a layout. I've pinched his layout, his scheme, general arrangement, if you like, because it's those simple things of a single hull, amphibious wheels, tractor engine. This is a very important bit, because you can't be sure a tractor engine on a float is going to work with the water coming over, all sorts. And this worked very well for Grover Loening in 1925 when he built his amphibian. And it grew up to be the Grumman Duck, actually. And there's been nice films made about that, too. But there's a biplane, whereas I'm a monoplane.
Yeah.
What a lovely question, you crook.
When do you think this thing will fly, Bill?
Well, I'll put it this way. We have a fortunate arrangement with the coxswain of the lifeboat at Calshot before he retired, which is Calshot is a seaplane station, famous one of the British. And he will be our safety boat down there, provided it's this year. So we've got until 31st of December 2005 to have it on the water under its own power. Now, whether it flies or not is a different matter. We would hope it would get airborne enough to just kiss the waves, because we're only allowed to kiss them, not to get airborne on a scrap machine.
You're not. So those are flying regulations, are they?
An aeroplane nowadays has to fly with a big piece of paper which says this is a certified aeroplane, either from the Civil Aviation Authority or from the what is called the Popular Flying Association.
Right.
Who issue permits to fly.
Right.
But this is outside that. This is a prototype being built, and if it does in fact get airborne nicely, it's worth building as a proper one, with the right materials and a stress calculations to prove it. It will fly, or it has flown. That's it.
And that's it, Bill. Well, look, thank you very, very much indeed for this tremendous contribution over two afternoons to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
You've made it so pleasant. You really have.
I'm extremely kind. Yeah. It's a great privilege for me to hear, and for everybody else who will be listening on this tape, to hear what someone of your vintage has to say about, especially about somewhere so interesting and special as Colditz, and to be one of those few people who built this glider, a story which everyone knows about. So I'd just like to say thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, I say thank you to you, because you have made it possible and enjoyable. It's the people I like to remember and think about. And
those that were lost, possibly, as well.
Yes, you can see them. Did I show you the photograph in the book? I did, didn't I? Of our crew standing on the airplane.
Yes, that might be a point to end with. Yes, Bill, thank you. You kindly brought along this afternoon a book, Wings Over Olympus, The Story of the Royal Air Force in Libya and Greece by T.H. Wisdom, published by George Allen and Unwin. And among the photographs is a picture of your aircraft in Kalamata Bay the day... perhaps the day that you ultimately crashed, or certainly the day before, and there's a picture of yourself standing on the aircraft with Flying Officer Lillian, was that right?
Yes, T-9048 is the ship, and Lillian, Flying Officer Lillian, is next to the gum boots, the flying boots, actually.
Which is you.
Who was the...
You're the
second officer of that particular ship at that time.
And you're the owner of a chap in the... You're the chap standing there in the gumboots.
Correct. And the rest of our crew, there are about three or four of them standing on the top. Davies, our engineer who survived also and came to Germany, he was down below. Yes, remember them well. Never to be forgotten. Such good folks. They did their job without question, whatever it was. And it ended up hard for some of them.
We'll end on that note, Bill. Thank you.